Doing another one of our long-form podcasts here. The Armstrong and Getty Show is a radio show heard on the West Coast with Jack Armstrong and Joe Getty, but we have these guests on all the time where we think we'd like to talk to them for a longer period of time than you get in commercial radio.
So let's do it with Mike Lyon, CBS News military analyst since February of 2003. What is your current title?
I'm a retired Army major. I'm a CBS military analyst. I'm actually going to be a fellow at the Modern War Institute at West Point this coming semester.
Oh, cool.
So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah,
I'm selected
awesome.
To do that. Hopefully help them with some social media and get into the weeds. My son was making fun of me. He said, there's no chance you'd ever get it. I'm a retail military analyst, right? I mean, that's really my gig. There's guys out there that, retired 4 stars with 35 years in that, I just get up every day and study the military. I talk to people and just kind of chip away at it and try to help educate. And when I go on your show, I feel on my Twitter feed, I can educate people on what's kind of going out there, what they should be focused on, I think. And then have a debate on something too. So anyway,
yeah,
but I'm looking forward to working with West Point.
Well, for folks who are hip to the on-air Armstrong and Getty show, you know that Mike Lyons has been an esteemed guest, a military analyst, among other things, for years. But whether it's the length of our segments or the fact that you have other stations you need to jump on or whatever, we always have to cut things short. And we always feel like we'd love to continue talking to you. So this is going to be fun.
That's great. Perfect.
Well, and with your permission, we want to depart from the usual thing, which is talking about geopolitics, especially as it pertains to the military. We'll do some of that. But we just wanted to talk about the realities of the American military and American military families for a little while. And why don't we start with a very broad question? What do you think is the state of the American military family in the year 2018?
Well, I think the American military family is held together, day to day, week to week, month to month. And it's based on the deployments of the soldiers that are out there. The military family, more than most, hangs on what a president says, no matter who the president is, because of that person is the commander in chief, is more cognizant of global affairs, recognizes places in the world where their loved one can be deployed to. And I think that, it creates a tremendous hardship on the family. I used to always say that if we keep this pace up that we're going at right now, which we have been going up, you're either, as a soldier, you're going to lose your mind or your family. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of families broken up because of the stress that's putting on it. And I think that and while the Army in particular is trying to do what it can, the mission is such that the soldier is just so stretched out doing so many different things. It hasn't broken yet. But I think in the future, we could possibly see, a real crisis.
Yeah, I wonder about that, too. I mean, whether it's the VA situation where, you could have served your country and even enjoyed your military experience. And then you get treated bad by the VA and you tell your kids, no, don't do it. They lie to you. They don't follow through their promises. Or I wonder about my brothers who was he's been in long enough to retire, but he's been in all kinds of deployments in the Middle East over the years, and his kids have not seen him for long periods of time. That's what they grew up with. I don't know if they're going to think their kids ought to get into it. I just wonder if, we'll continue to have generations of military families.
I think that one of the unfortunate aspects of the military, especially in the last 20 years, in the last generation, let's say, has been this. It's become the family business, and that's just not necessarily the way to go. From a nepotistic perspective, I think, given the fact that how it's going to linger within the families and how things will go, I don't think you get the turnover. You don't get others in society contributing to the military. The military should reflect the civilian society in all ways, shapes, forms, and sizes, and sometimes it doesn't. The demographics aren't such that it doesn't do that there as well. But in particular, enduring the hardship is something that military families have to go through. And, you do that over time and you're going to miss a lot of things. You're going to miss a lot of kids' baseball games. You're going to miss you're going to be away for a lot of birthday parties. And you kind of hope that it works out. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't.
Well, let's stay micro for a minute. Then I want to talk about the macro issue of the way, America chooses and pays and the rest of it, it's military. But you talked about wearing soldiers out, the multiple deployments. How is that different from generations past? What's changed?
Just the number alone and the duration of these deployments. Prior to 2003, prior to the situation of these endless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you could go potentially 20 years and not have any deployment at all. You look back from 1975 through Desert Storm, 1991, there weren't soldiers deployed all around the world. They were stationed in certain places. A hardship tour back then was considered a 13-month tour unaccompanied without your family to go to Korea. And that was it. And now that's completely changed. You can deploy for 6 months in Afghanistan, come home to rest for 12 to 18 months, and you're right back then in Afghanistan. So people are doing multiple deployments. Go back to the reserve units, even in particular, they shifted so much of the combat power into reserve units after the Vietnam War, given what happened. There was a time when you would join a reserve unit to go pay for college. There was almost virtually no expectation you were going to deploy. If you're in a reserve unit within the military right now, the Army in particular, you're going down range at some point. You're going for a long period of time. It's going to take you out of your job. It's going to take you away from your family.
Well, and put you in the way of serious danger and stress and the rest of it, which, is a change, as you were saying.
Mm-hmm. And I think what we require these soldiers to do nowadays is another impossible mission, and that's flip this switch from being a war fighter to a peacekeeper. You go to certain areas, and in this block, I'm a war fighter. I've got to fight and defend what's going on. But then the next block, I'm a peacekeeper trying to keep two sides within a civilian population from killing each other. And I had an argument with a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of all things at a social event once that I just think it's impossible to expect our soldiers, and in particular our Marines, who are killers. Our Marines don't join up to be peacekeepers. They're not joining up any place to, hand out flowers and MREs to people. And I just think it's impossible, no matter how disciplined that unit is, to flip a switch between being a warfighter and a peacekeeper. And I think that's one of the other challenges I never had to deal with. I trained to basically, fight as infantry when required, fight artillery, fight in combat, fight in wars. And this whole issue about phase five peacekeeping is another thing that the military has taken on because it needs the budget money, but it's really now an important mission. It's a critical mission.
Well, on a similar topic, and I say this not to toot our own horns, in fact, just the opposite. We've been honored and privileged to be part of some pretty major fundraising efforts for various causes that include, soldiers, sailors, Marines, military families, et cetera, veterans. And at some of the gatherings, we have talked to guys who are recently back from Afghanistan, Iraq, and what they've told us about the rules of engagement have left me enraged. I mean, actually red-faced and vibrating with anger that mm-hmm. they have to wait until they are certain they are in mortal danger before they return fire or before they fire, which in many cases ends up with dead Marines, dead American mm-hmm. boys. And I wish the public knew a little more about that, but that flows directly from what you were saying, the idea that they're there to be ambassadors of goodwill when they're not killing mm-hmm. machines.
Yeah, I mean, because of all the rules of engagement and combat and warfare are totally been blurred in this age of fighting terrorism. In the old days, the enemy wore a uniform, they were across a certain border. There was somewhat of a fight with honor. There was, rules of war that were well defined. At today's, you look at the green on blue attack you have in Afghanistan. There's just the picture is so cloudy. It's called asymmetrical warfare, 360 degrees all around. We just expect our soldiers, Marines, sailors, everybody to have this 360 degree awareness. I mean, I try to teach my kids to think 6 inches past their nose, let alone now to try to think 360 degrees around them in order for a threat to come, even in places where you're supposed to be safe and secure. And go back to those rules of engagement. You might not even be able to engage once the shooting starts. So it is a challenge. And I just don't think you can flip a switch. Human nature comes in and takes over on things that don't always count.
Boy, and how about switching the flipping the switch back off once you come home and get out? We hear a lot about homelessness, suicide rates, all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. Is it even realistic to expect people to, especially in the, maybe if you're, in your late teens, early 20s, really forming your brain and the way your body reacts to life, then to go back to normal life? Is that even a reasonable expectation?
No, I agree. And I think from my perspective, I prepared my whole adult life to go to combat. I went to the military academy. I studied the history of war. I studied the military art. I read, books about platoon leaders. I read about what men and did at Christmas time, for example, and Bastogne, and how they you know, how they held it together, knowing that when I spent Christmas in a combat zone, I felt almost privileged, the fact that I had almost been there before in some kind of weird way. So I think it gets back to preparation. And so I felt when I came home, it was just, you know, there's clearly nothing like a war zone. There's nothing like a combat zone in terms of the morality and the norms that exist there. But I think we've just sent too many people into that area without that pre-preparation. They sign up for different reasons. You know, they sign up to actually go to war. You don't want actually those kinds of people somewhere around you. They're going to get everybody killed if they're out there just to kill anybody. You need smart people. We've unfortunately dropped some of those standards in the past here as well. So it all gets back to being prepared to go to war before you get there, and then that'll help you on the adjustment coming back.
Well, and it seems to me that any people with a conscience would understand the difficulty of that adjustment coming back and would have pretty well-developed programs to deal with that. You know, I'm thinking about the fact, have you had a chance to get to read Sebastian Younger's fabulous book, Tribe?
I've not read that one. I've read the other book, the one on Korigal and what took place there. I saw the documentary and I thought,
yeah,
boy, if this isn't Vietnam, I don't know what is. I mean, it just I didn't like the lack of discipline in that unit. You know, just got all cards on the table. And I met him and I talked to him about it. And, you know, because that's not what the military, the Army in particular needs and wants, is this other kind of Vietnam situation where it's almost survival of the fittest. I didn't like, you know, I didn't think the officers were treated in a manner that they should have been. It was not a very good snapshot, I thought, of what should a unit look like.
Right. But the book Tribe is all about the way we tend to band together as Homo sapiens and the thing and how strong that need is. And he talks a great deal about folks in the military and coming back home and how a young man or a woman will have an experience where they have a life and death trust with a fairly small group of people. And that is so incredibly satisfying to the human soul. And it's also so necessary in a war zone. But then one of the aspects of PTSD or difficulty adjusting back is you get back to the stupid, petty, slow paced real world, quote unquote. And that's it's really hard for guys. And, you know, the famous contrast is that at the end of WW2, it took months for these guys to get back home in, you know, the in country centers, then weeks on a cruise ship, then being mustered out, et cetera, et cetera. And now it's literally a nonstop plane flight and there you are back in Omaha.
Yeah. And on top of that, while you've been in combat, you've been FaceTiming with your family and you know, communication is instant in some ways. You've got a lot more exposure to the outside world. And I do agree that when you do come home, I mean, look, the reality of combat is it provides this adrenaline rush that's really pretty hard to replicate. You know, I'm a sports guy, I like a lot of sports analogies, but it's still nothing close, especially if you're successful. I mean, our units were in Desert Storm, for example, were just so successful. It was no match, and your level of invincibility just was sent to a whole different level that when you do things in the future, you kind of compare and contrast to that, you know, how you felt about that. So you're right. It's hard to find that feeling again, especially when you run up against civilians. I've run up to civilians in the job force that have literally, you know, we're asking about getting people in. And I said, why don't we recruit some veterans? I know a couple of guys we can go after. And literally I had senior people telling me, we really want to do that? Those guys are all damaged. We don't want to do that. And I said, well, am I damaged? Then how do I look? I mean, am I coming off in a way that's damaged? So
God, I'd be tempted to damage them for saying that.
Adjustment is a challenge, and it's there.
Yeah.
This just popped into my head. How good is our military? I remember hearing, I think it was John McCain one time, he was asked the question about how good is our military? Because, you know, as Americans, we get a great charge out of, I know I have my whole life, of we have the best military in the world, right? We could beat anybody, and we take pride in that. But I heard John McCain talking about it, and they said, have you ever faced any soldiers that, or know of any soldiers that were as good as, you know, the U.S.? And he said the North Vietnamese regulars were as good. What's your experience with that? Are we better than everybody else? Who out there compares to us?
We are, for a couple of different reasons. Number one, we have the best technology that you could imagine. And when we get into a combat situation in a combat zone, all that technology comes to play. I can tell you, when I was in a combat zone, all things showed up that I'd never even seen before, and we were successful in implementing it quickly to, you know, in our operations and systems. So that's number one. Number two, we have that, not only the technology, but the equipment in it above itself. Our equipment, it depends on survivability. We build tanks and APCs and armor personnel carriers and equipment and planes that survives combat. And in order for the soldier to feel confident in it, I looked at Soviet tanks and I've looked at Soviet armored personnel carriers, and they're just tin cans. They're just death traps. So our protection of the force is something that's very important to the soldier. But then the third thing is, at the end of the day, our military is superb because it trains in a combined arms way. And we truly fight like the Germans did in the Second World War with this, you know, we call it airland battle. They were, you know, combining tanks and combining airplanes and infantry on the ground in that blitzkrieg. It's the same thing. Fighting the way we fight, when we put all our things together, when we wind this big fist up and we take the time and wind it all up, there's nothing on the planet that can defeat the U.S. military when it decides to put its mind to something.
That's interesting.
A great coach doesn't roll around pleasuring himself over his team's strengths. He talks about they go after what the team isn't doing well. What's wrong with the U.S. military? What's weak, or what's wrong with the Pentagon specifically? What could be better?
The Pentagon is such a bureaucracy that can't adjust to the civilians and the political environment. And I think that is the biggest challenge right now. And while it's trying to adjust, you know, the Pentagon has got to work off intent so many ways, and it moves down the highway. I saw, you know, so as it's trying to acquire weapons, there's people in the Pentagon that are looking 20, 30 years down the road on technology that the military has to buy right now. And there's things that the Pentagon has to do now that affect that down the road. But politicians are just worried about getting reelected in the next 2 to 4 years and whether or not those projects get funded or not. So the Pentagon, you know, has to do 10 or 15 things and do a lot of make work stuff for things that end up not happening, go sit on a shelf someplace, because they can't adjust to the political environment. Once in combat, though, once you unleash the Pentagon and unleash the power of the military, again, the resources go, intent is followed. Look, there's no other organization aside from the military that can get to Ebola and fight a pandemic that exists there. I mean, Napoleon would never send his army into that kind of environment. The military can get to Haiti. The military can get anywhere else in the world, the Navy. And once it cranks it up, it can do it. But sometimes it gets caught up in the bureaucracy of politics, and I think that's its biggest
challenge. That's interesting that the last two questions and answers go together. So the Pentagon with its, you know, having to think years in the future and the politics holding back and all this, yet we still are ahead of all these authoritarian countries where they can make decisions on a dime. One person can make that decision. How do we stay ahead of all these people?
It's money. I mean, you look at the budget that was just approved, over $700 billion. We have a budget that's, you know, 10 times the next competitor that's out there. And so, and the military industrial complex is a tremendous jobs program. I mean, let's face it, we make things that we don't even use in some levels. And so I think that, you bring all that together, the fact that we do invest what we invest in the military, and you combine that with the technology, and it gets back to from now the world is so much shorter, you know, smaller. If you're our enemy right now, that's the thing. If you're our enemy right now, you're not even going to try to fight the United States conventionally. I mean, H.R. McMaster said that recently. It'd be stupid for you to do something like that. The next battle is happening in cyber. The next battle is happening in that fifth domain, possibly even space. I mean, Trump's got it right here with this Space Force. Somebody goes and takes out all our satellites, takes out a lot of the technology in space, we could be blinded. That's a real problem. So the next battle is not going to happen conventionally on the ground, even though we're still preparing for that.
A couple more Pentagon questions. I keep hearing that we have a shortage of spare parts for our aircraft. Is that true, more or less?
It is, but I will tell you this. The Air Force doesn't do a great job of managing that. I mean, all cards on the table, because the Air Force is pretty smart. The Air Force funds its people programs first. It funds its golf courses and its housing projects and things and makes sure all of that happens. And so when the Air Force runs out of money, they go and claim, look, our spare parts aren't here. And it's their way of trying to get money from extra money from Congress that they didn't budget for. Other service branches don't do that. The Army is so big, it has a challenge to do that. So they've done this before. That's what their MO is. Hmm. So for them to say that they don't have spare parts, that is 100% their fault, their responsibility.
You're not anti-golf course, are you, Mike Lyons? I won't hear it.
Yeah, somebody should be fired over that. The bottom line is this. I worked for a general officer who said, if I give you all the resources you ask for and I give you all those things, I expect you to get the job done. Well, the Congress allocates the Air Force all the resources it needs to get the job done. If they're going to want to come because they misallocated something on their side, that's on them.
All right, one more question of that sort. I remember Bob Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, talking about his frustration trying to get the MRAPs, the more advanced armored vehicles, to the guys who were getting killed over and over again by IEDs, and that even he, as the Secretary of Defense, found it incredibly frustrating to deal with the bureaucracy of the Pentagon. That troubled me a lot.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that just has to do with there was no anticipation of that as a requirement. It took a lot longer from an acquisition cycle perspective. There was nothing commercially available on the shelf called COTS. There's nothing that they could have, you know, picked out of a Ford factory or you know, a Chrysler or a GM factory that could have modified it because of kind of the purple squirrel that gets made every time, you know, a military equipment is ordered. No one kind of thought that through. We ended up not having, you know, going to war in a manner that we had gone in the past. For Desert Storm, we waited 6 months. We kind of wound that big fist up, and then when we unleashed it, it was pretty violent and brutal. This time here, we kind of did a just-in-time war with Rumsfeld, and we didn't bring everything to the battle that we needed to bring. And Rumsfeld even said to himself, you know, you go to war with the equipment you have. So we just didn't kind of think it through.
Interesting. What was that purple squirrel metaphor?
Yeah, so the military often wants a purple squirrel in order to accomplish a certain mission. So you can't get something commercially available off the shelf. It's got to be redesigned from the ground up. And no one anticipated the level of IEDs, which are nothing more than, you know, landmines, but no one anticipated that they would have to do that. So the military, you know, wanted a purple squirrel. There was none available commercially. They had to redesign them. So from an acquisition perspective, it took them a while to get them downrange.
Interesting. I'll use that the rest of my life. So you've been studying the military your whole life. I have too, as a guy who never served, and I always thought I'd join the military, and then I didn't for some reason. I got into radio, but I've read so many books and, you know, firsthand accounts of being in this war or that war and all that sort of stuff. I've been fascinated a couple of articles in the last year or so about how one of the ways Hitler pulled off the whole Blitzkrieg thing was everybody was methed up. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Everybody was all hopped up on meth, and that's how Churchill was wondering, how did they do this? How did they march that far in that many days? How did they pull that off? And they're just using meth.
I know when we fight in Somalia, there's a product there called CAT that the soldiers on the other side, the terrorists, whatever you want to call them, the warlord soldiers, whatever, they're all hopped up on that. When we fought them, go back to Mogadishu in 93, the battle there, I talked to one of the Delta commander on the ground is a classmate of mine. He's a good friend of mine. He's actually going to take over Afghanistan, Scotty Miller. And I asked him about what it was like to fight against those guys. And he says, they just keep coming at you because of this drug that they're on, this narcotic drug that just gives them no fear. And they just don't stop. Doesn't surprise me. And again, it gets, you know, that's how people compete athletically. They do something different to their body because there's no question combat in the military can wear down your body if you're not careful.
That's interesting. One of the reasons I bring it up, I don't know if you've ever read Keegan's classic Faces of Battle, I think it is, where he takes on three different battles throughout history, 1200s, 1500s, and 1800s, I think, if I remember correctly, and just what the battles was like. But one thing they all had in common was they got boozed up. A lot of them got boozed up before they fought. It was just, you know, I know I feel tougher and more invincible when I get a little boozed up. Do we do that, or have we done that in the past?
No, not in the military I've seen. Not in my time or experience in the last, let's say, 30, 35 years. Now, again, I got in just after the Vietnam era, and we had some challenges for sure with soldiers back, you know, late 70s, you know, early 80s with them coming from Vietnam. But for going into battle, I wouldn't say we have anything close to that.
Hey, speaking of Vietnam, what do you think of the idea of a draft and or compulsory service of the Israeli model?
Yeah, I just think it's too hard for our country to try to pull something like that off, a draft. I don't think, and the Army doesn't want it. I know in particular because you want people that are going to volunteer, they're going to want to be there. They don't want this kind of turnover. All these countries that have that, the compulsory military model, in some cases is because they have to defend their land. Switzerland's got a 14-year compulsory model. The Israelis get up every day wondering if the Arabs have massed at the border and they got to go defend their country. I mean, today, compared to, again, 20, 30 years ago, that's probably not going to be a high probability. Or the missiles will come from Iran or someplace else. But I think it's great in sound, and I think, but from a logistical perspective, it's just too hard to manage.
And, well, and people you don't want to pay attention at least.
Who can't get there from here.
At least people would pay attention all of a sudden. I find it hard to believe we'd still be in Afghanistan kind of mucking around not with a clear goal after all these years if everybody either was on the way or their kid was on their way.
I know, and I look at Afghanistan, and it's more like Vietnam to me, but we can't lose it because we won't have the same level of losses. But there's probably an undercurrent in the Pentagon that likes the fact that we've got troops downrange, that we could use it as a test bed for a laboratory, and it keeps us engaged in combat. And with the unspoken word of, you know, this president, no president wants to be the one that gets us out of Afghanistan and has this, you know, visual of the helicopter landing on the embassy and we have to get out of there. But, you know, if we wanted to get out of Afghanistan, we could. Look, Barack Obama did it. We got us out of Iraq, just said, this is what we're doing. You know, put a stake in the ground, 12/31, 2011, goodbye, good luck, Godspeed all travelers. And obviously what happened was a lot worse. But if we wanted to get out, we could get out.
We had a long conversation recently with your colleague, Laura Logan, and she, from her reporting and talking to sources and all, was pretty confident that, look, we are there and going to remain there, number one, so Afghanistan doesn't descend into complete lawlessness, also as a counterbalance to the Pakistanis and the Iranians in the region, and that we are going to have a couple of massive bases, and it's going to be more like a limited occupation than a quote-unquote war for a very long time.
Yeah, and that doesn't surprise me. Like the South Korea model, the biggest thing that I felt about leaving Iraq was we were going to just lose out on that opportunity to have a big base there. If you had the 1st Armored Division in Iraq, and if it stayed in Iraq at the end of that conflict, you wouldn't have had ISIS. You would have had a completely different scenario. Now, you still might have had, you know, the Shia and Sunni, you know, challenges there. But Iran acts differently. Everything acts differently when, you know, 384 main battle tanks can drive due north and in 12 hours be in either Damascus in Syria or in Tehran in Iran. So we gave up a big, you know, a big leg in the game when we gave up Iraq, and the Pentagon's just not going to let that mistake happen again. We're going to build stuff inside of Afghanistan. We're going nowhere. And I think we're going to end up having 20,000 troops there at some point that'll be combat troops.
So this is a big, dumb question, but it's intended to get us to something that's not dumb. The oft-repeated question, are we going to be the policeman of the world? You know, to some extent, yes, we are, because American presence ensures the free flow of commerce and the preservation of human rights, et cetera, all over the world in a way that benefits the hell out of the American people. Sometimes I wonder if the president appreciates that, the current guy. But obviously, we cannot be in every hellhole where human rights are being denied or injustice is being done.
Right. And we pick our places mostly based on economics. And right now we project power mostly with our Navy, with our, you know, 11 air carrier Navy that and Pacific and Atlantic Fleet, if we can keep them from bumping into each other. I think that, though, what we've done, though, in the military is we've built this standoff military. And our technology with cruise missiles and, you know, hitting something, you know, 500 miles away, that's changed that whole thing about, I think, policemen. Because in the past, we interpreted that world's policemen as having, you know, troops on the ground. I won't say boots on the ground because that's insulting, but troops actually there, again, enduring the hardship, Marines, Army, that are actually doing things. Our answer right now, everything is still cruise missiles and drones and 500 miles away and, you know, watching on a screen someplace in Missouri and then, you know, taking people down that way.
Well, it's interesting how that plays politically, too, because Barack Obama did many more drone strikes than George Bush ever did. For some reason, the public's okay with us atomizing people from above, you know, with no trial, and sometimes right. We don't even hear about it. It just politically, it works a lot better to be a policeman that way.
Yeah, and the ratio is literally something like 520-8. You know, the Obama administration launched 520, you know, cruise missiles and drone strikes versus 8 that George Bush did. It wasn't even close. So, and you know, there's a lot of whoopses that happened there. We've hit things that we shouldn't have hit. There's probably been friendly fire on our side, and so, but it's antiseptic. You can kind of go to wash your hands. You can, you know, I've never been guy where I know Air Force guys can do this. They could literally, you know, get in a plane in Germany, fly a combat mission over Iraq or someplace in the Middle East, and then go back and have dinner with their family. You know, so that's where we're at right now. There's not a lot of people that are downrange that are enduring the hardship, except, you know, the Army and the Marines.
So as long as we're in the Middle East, let's talk a little specific geopolitics. What did Barack Obama get right and wrong about Syria, and how has it left us where we are now?
What did he get right on Syria? Let's see.
Well, I mean, for instance, just if you share this opinion, I often said Barack Obama did nothing and he did it poorly, because maybe nothing was all that could be done, you know, in that mess.
Right. Barack Obama, I think, allowed Hillary Clinton and others to dictate what was going to be important. Libya, for example, and how that became a high priority for the administration. And look what happened there. I think by the time Syria comes around, he is completely disinterested in what's going on there.
Because he's been burned.
He doesn't have any really kind of stake in the game, doesn't have an economic interest, but not seeing the geopolitical issue of the Iranians getting involved, not recognizing what the impact that has been on Iraq, and completely oblivious to the Kurds and their plight that they have, and with no kind of vision. Barack Obama's entire presidency from a foreign policy perspective was to get to his last day in office. And you got to look at good presidents, I think, that look well over the horizon and set things up for things to happen when they leave office. Barack Obama then focused so much on the Iranian nuclear deal, and all that was about was making sure that the Iranians didn't get nukes while he was in office, because they're going to have him 10 years down the road based on that deal. So he got a lot wrong. The biggest mistake he made was allowing the Russians back in, giving them the keys to take control of their chemical weapons, which obviously was not well defined, because they might have gotten rid of some of their sarin gas and some of their persistent nerve agent, but they still had a lot of other things to kill civilians with.
Yeah, that's interesting. Ben Rhodes from the Obama administration has written a book recently, and he talks about during that period of time when they're trying to decide what to do with Syria, and it was a short term, you know, and what you just said, trying to get to the end of his office. That's really interesting, because it was maybe a little self-centered or U.S.-centered short-term thinking of what will be good for individual soldiers, or I hate to be so crass to just say politically, but well, short-term mm-hmm. thinking. You know, it didn't look like getting involved in Libya did any good. Remember, we went in because I think Barack Obama made this announcement that the word was on the street that Gaddafi was going to go door-to-door and start slaughtering people, and we weren't going to stand by and let that happen. Well, we certainly let that happen a lot in Syria, but Barack Obama felt like whether we get involved or not, that's going to happen, so why would we be involved?
Yeah, and there's nobody to drone. He drew a red line, didn't do anything about it. I think that was a real problem as well. And he just wasn't interested, and not recognizing the guys in the Pentagon were, though. The guys in the Pentagon recognizes the Kurds were going to have a home at some point, and they were looking to have that as the eastern part of Syria. And you look well over the horizon and you say Syria, Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, that's a pretty formidable alliance of those countries. And if we don't do something to disrupt that, we're going to have a problem in the future.
Well, Liz Sly, who we also talked to not long ago, wrote a great piece, I think it was a year and a half, 2 years ago, 10 potential wars that could erupt from Syria / Iraq. And she's just nailed it one after the other. The ugly ain't even begun in that region, potentially speaking. What's the big flashpoint? You mentioned the Kurds. They're obviously going to be one of them, but what do you anticipate?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. 30 million people that consider themselves part of something called Kurdistan that don't have an indigenous country, and yet have all the capabilities to have a country, natural resources that exist where they live. You carve out a piece of Turkey, Iran, Syria, and Iraq, and you can clearly get a country out of that that defends itself, that can participate in the modern world. And they're going to likely have to fight a war to do it. And NATO's going to have to get involved at some point to stop it, because the Turks are going to prevent it on some level. And we've already seen some of the human suffering that's taken place. Our country has historically supported this, and now we're kind of backing down off of it. I don't think Donald Trump doesn't get it yet. The previous, George Bush got it, and maybe Bill Clinton got it a little bit. Barack Obama wanted nothing to do with it.
Kurds are pretty good fighters too, right?
They are, and they fight with literally sticks and rocks. They fight with weapons from the 1940s and 50s. But what they're smarter and they're committed, and it's just kind of a classic, they've got something to fight for. They get up every day and realize that if they don't defend this area, if they don't fight, that they're not going to survive. Their families are not going to survive. So they have it ingrained in their culture.
Boy, and we're talking about all this different stuff. And the original reason we went into Afghanistan, obviously, was to not have another 9/11. How much of this has an effect on terrorism in the United States, which was the whole point of all of this at one point?
Right. And I think, but if we don't go into Iraq, that's where the world changed. The going into Afghanistan was for the right reasons. And if we had focused our efforts on that and done that in a manner that really set up the Afghan government and moved that forward, it would have worked. But the Bush administration, they're going to go down in history as making the biggest mistake, and obviously in the 21st century, when it comes to this selective war going into Iraq, and what's happened since then. That's been the tipping point from my perspective. The world has changed since that March day when we decided to start bombing inside and taking down the Iraqi government. Well, that's been the problem. We've upset the apple cart now to the point where we can't even predict what's going to happen.
That's really interesting. It'll be hard to explain in future generations. How did the United States end up in Iraq? I mean, it'll take some doing.
Well, not only that, but then to try to explain how that questionable idea was implemented. I mean, yeah. The actual implementation of the plans, the decisions made, L. Paul Bremer chapter of the thing, the dismissing the entire Ba'athist mm-hmm. regime. It's just, in retrospect, it was just nightmarishly mishandled.
Right. And taking 400,000 troops in the Iraqi army and unemploying them automatically and trying to use some model that they thought was from World War II about the denazification, de-bathification, whatever they were calling it. This is where, and frankly, the civilian think tanks also have some blame. You look at the neocons that are, on the Democrat side now, because they're all never Trumpers. They have a lot of responsibility. They got their fingerprints on this as well. So it was a, poor strategy and even executed poorly when the time came.
So here's my new thing, Mike. I think we're underemphasizing our own hemisphere. Do you spend much time thinking about Central and South America and the incredibly unstable politics and potential violence there?
No, I don't. I know the Pentagon does, and I know that the Pentagon back in the 80s did get involved with a lot of the drug cartels, but that's all waned away. And, we don't focus on South America, what's going on there, and the fact that these drugs are coming through the border, and we don't focus on what's going on in Mexico for whatever reason. I think, again, we're still fighting the last war, and we're concerned about a world war in Europe that could possibly take place. But, there's a tremendous amount of resources we could focus here. And, so go back to Barack Obama again. If Barack Obama decided to say, we're not going to focus on that right now, I'm going to really focus efforts towards Central and South America, that would have been fine. But they didn't. They didn't do anything. They just basically kind of ran the clock out. But I know from a military perspective, we're doing what we can on intel collection. But knowing full well that we still have to be careful, because we've never really sent troops anywhere within our own hemisphere. We've always sent them overseas to fight.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking more in terms of foreign policy than military action specifically. But I think we in the United States ought to be putting political correctness aside, good luck with that, and studying the hell out of the refugee crisis in Europe and the stresses that that's causing. Because if the instability grows in Venezuela and El Salvador and Honduras and the rest of them, I mean, we could be looking at a hell of a refugee crisis, and we already have societal strains based mm-hmm. on, call it an invasion, call it a migration, call it a flood of refugees.
One thing we have to our advantage, though, is space. The refugees in Europe, kind of get there on boats, and there's whole, kind of businesses that are set up there. And you look at what happened in Germany, for example. I went to Germany a couple of years ago. It's completely different. And they're going to – what Trump said, they're going to lose their culture. I think he what he means is not only are people coming there, but they're just not assimilating. It's the challenge I think we have in our country too as well. I mean, we want people to assimilate and be Americans. It's okay to come here. You got to come legally, but you have to assimilate. But I think it's a lot harder for people in those countries in South America to still get here, because there's really not a mechanism to get them here unless they go by land through, what are some pretty tough conditions.
Yeah, if you've never looked at a map, it's easy to forget that Africa and Europe are like, how long would it take in a decent power boat to get from Libya to Italy? I mean, I don't think you're some sort of power boating expert. It not long is the answer.
No, not long. Right. Exactly. And people have been doing it since, for 500 years. I mean, and for what goes on there. And there's lots of commerce and things that can travel, that can take people and make them get into that spot. And once they get there, then they just declare, and then from there they can move through Europe freely because of the European Union.
So how about the what the Obama administration was attempting to do was shift away from Middle Eastern problems dominating our lives to China as the up-and-coming. Is threat the right word? Is China a threat, or are they just going to overtake us as an economy at some point?
Well, that's supposedly by 2025 they would in size. But, you know, the pivot to the Pacific that never has happened again from the administration, that administration's perspective, and then from the military's perspective, a lot of it was based on, believe it or not, global warming, because we thought some of those islands that exist there in the South Pacific were going to be 50 feet and more underwater. They were going to displace millions of people. We were going to have to do, you know, we were pouring all this money into, again, something that just hasn't happened yet. That was kind of their vision of it. China, though, was a threat.
I was not aware of that. That's what drove the pivot to China, was global warming and worry about the islands going underwater?
Yeah, that's right. And what the pressure that would do to the Navy, that our Navy would have to, it would be rescuing a million people or immigrants or a million refugees on a yearly basis or more, as the shores would rise and people would be, you know, losing their homes. And so, I don't know why we assume that mission, but that was the basis of a lot of what that pivot to the Pacific was about.
Meanwhile, China's taken a generations-long view of things and building those little islands that, of course, they will not militarize till the moment they militarize it 10 minutes later. Mm-hmm. How much does that concern you, the idea that China may be maneuvering itself into a position where it can choke off commercial sea lanes and free navigation?
Well, as long as we fund our Navy and continue to have a presence there, I just don't think that'll happen, because if they want to have a military fight there, it's going to be no match, because we won't fight it on the ground. We couldn't manufacture a billion bullets to kill the Chinese that we'd have to kill. It would come from space. It would come from the sea. And eventually we would have, you know, all of the wherewithal in order to do something there if they decided to do that. I don't think they're dumb enough to do that. And they do take that long in the tooth approach. I mean, you can argue that because of China's population, eventually they should be able to win every event in the Olympics, right? You know, the billion people, they should find everybody that's 7 foot tall, they can win every basketball game. So from a military perspective, you look at them and say, but they still can't hold and keep ground that they want to have. And just like us, we wouldn't have that fight. Where would we want to fight China from the Army's perspective? So it happens in the sea lanes, and it'll happen in cyber. I think that's what we've got to be concerned about.
You know, I always throw this in when people are talking about ascendant China. They have amazing demographic problems coming down the road, which, you know, keep an eye on that. It'll mm-hmm. be more like Japan now than Japan in the 80s, which everybody said was going to take over and rule the world, et cetera, et cetera.
I want to get to everything before we wear you out and you finally hang up on us, but we haven't talked anything about, you know, because we're talking about various threats around the world. Isn't this still the greatest threat out there, for really for all of mankind? It's amazing. Nobody would have predicted this, that nobody has set off a nuke in anger since the 40s. At some point, that's going to happen, isn't it?
Well, it's down to accountability of nuclear weapons, number one, and the strict, you know, you just can't make that. You've got to be an industrialized nation to have it. It's only 8 countries that or even have this nuclear capability to enrich it. And it can't be shrunk. I was, you know, the new Mission Impossible movie talks about how they're going to have some suitcase nuclear weapon. It's just, this doesn't make, that's not something that someone can make right now without the accountability that goes with having a nuclear weapon. But just the fact that there hasn't been an accident. Now, there's been a couple of accidents. In fact, there was some in the 80s. Some guy dropped a wrench down a missile silo there, and that almost blew half of Arkansas away. There have been challenges. But to your point, statistically, you would think something would have happened. And when it ever does, as this nuclear arsenal ages and metal rusts and the equipment to maintain it goes offline and floppy disks that are no longer used to launch it get changed, there's a real possibility that could happen.
Wow. So you're more concerned. Well, I won't speak for you, but are you more concerned about decay and irresponsibility than, say, Pakistan and India getting into a beef or North Korea selling their technology to ISIS or that sort of thing?
No, I'm concerned about North Korea and the proliferation of their technology, because they're not going to unlearn what they have. But whether or not other countries can get the material to do it is another question. And we can control that to some degree. So that is an issue. There's no question. I think I am concerned about our nuclear arsenal because, I mean, I hate to talk about the Air Force again, but the bottom line is the Air Force works it and the Air Force doesn't care about it because the Air Force wants to fly F-16s and they want to fly and do all the sexy stuff. And the guys that do the nuclear mission don't get promoted. They're all disgruntled. You see the drug problems we've had in a couple of silos. And to me, it's a real lack of leadership. And someone better be paying attention to make sure that that equipment there is not eroding or is still functional because we still might have to use it, God forbid, at some point.
Yeah, back to North Korea, just briefly, I grew up in Chicagoland. And if I was on the west side of Chicago right now and I've got a really, really good expensive gun and I am absolutely desperate for cash, it's not difficult to imagine what I'm going to do. And so, yeah, North Korea, my God, the idea of them proliferating is... it's got to be front and center all the time.
Not only their nuclear capability, but their missile technology, because North Korea has a quasi space program, good, not great. And in order to have this ICBM capability, you have to really have a space program, which is why anytime they've launched these missiles in the past, we don't know what they're hitting and they just go into the water. For them to say they could hit the West Coast remains to be seen. But you got to have, in most cases, you do have to have this space program and missiles in order to ensure that you can hit the other side of it. But if North Korea propagates that technology to Iran with more of what's going on the nuclear side, then the Iranians come up 10 years from now with this nuclear power. The Israelis will stand for that for about maybe 5 to 10 minutes. And then all of, the F-18s get deployed from there. And then that war starts because the Israelis are not going to put up with the Iranians having any kind of nuclear capability.
It's just amazing that if you sit around and have a conversation with a smart person like you, or maybe it's dumb guys in a bar or whatever, and you're discussing, military things, what could happen? You always end up back in the Middle East. You always end up back in religious arguments that are several thousand years old, driving what's going to blow up the world. It's just incredible.
Speaking of which, one more geopolitical hotspot, if we may. It's a pivot point between Europe and Asia, between the Muslim world, the Christian world. Turkey has got to be, unless North Korea sells the missiles, as you're describing, et cetera, et cetera. Turkey, to me, is going to be the center of all that is truly dangerous in the next 5 years. And that is that's a regime that's teetering. It's a fairly powerful military. You got the Kurdish thing. They're all tied into Turkey.
Second largest military after the US and NATO is Turkey. And this regime is not good for the United States and United States interests. And in the past, Turkey had been the way we communicated with the Iranians. Go back to the 80s and the 90s. When, on the outset, it looked like we were never doing anything with Iran. We were able to communicate with them through Turkey. So they'd always been a conduit and always been a really close ally. But what's going on there now is really scary. And again, they have our nuclear weapons inside of Turkey at Incirlik Air Base in some of these locations. They claim that they're not there. I mean, they're not ICBMs. But the bottom line is they've got them in their possession. And that leader there is, off the wall. He's unhinged for no question. And I think that from the United States' perspective, we need to be watching that a lot closely. And the Trump administration putting sanctions on them until we release this political prisoners, we're not off to a good start there right now.
Did you just say Turkey has the second biggest army behind the United States in NATO?
Yeah, I believe that's what they do in terms of what they spend in NATO itself. They're bigger than UK, Canada, those other ones in terms of what they spend. Absolutely.
Well, that's interesting.
I didn't know that.
No.
So listen, final question for me, unless I come up with another one. A good buddy of mine who is no longer with us, God rest his soul, he was a Marine. He was one of my best childhood friends, and he would occasionally refer to me as a silly villain, which I actually appreciated because I like a good insult, and I loved him. What should or could the civilian folks who are listening to this podcast do or remember or donate? How do civilians support America's military? How should we?
I just say this, that anybody who is in the military came from the civilian world, and they're a reflection of the civilian world and their values. And if you were, squared away, and if you were smart and you were, a good citizen and you loved your country before you went in the military, you did that when you come out of the military. The kind of the dirty little secret is, unfortunately, there's some people that were crazy when they got in. They got the military let them in, and then they're crazy, then they're out, and they get painted with this broad brush. as the military made that happen. The military caused that to happen. But I'm always try to pick that out before whether or not someone was crazy based on whether they, you know, whether they were before the military, after the military. But the bottom line is this, most veterans, I would say, just don't necessarily have to be thanked for their service. It's something that when I am, I say, you know, listen, I volunteered and I appreciate it. And thanks for paying your taxes and the whole thing. But most people don't want to project that, veterans don't want to project that value back, that other people have to do it or insist upon doing it. So I think that, you know, the break that the civilians would want to say is just, you know, ask them, what can I, any idea to help you kind of assimilate, or you're doing something right now, what's kind of going on? Because just like everybody, we're all carrying a burden to something. And, you know, if you're a veteran or not a veteran, you're carrying something. So to just be a citizen of the United States and support your government and support, you know, your town and your city and have them make sure they make that contribution.
Sometimes support them by being critical of them too. I mean, obviously I know you know that.
I know from my brother at various times when he was in Iraq for the longest period of time, come over and mow his lawn. And his kids were little and his wife was busy.
Yeah, remember the sacrifices military families are making, I'd suggest too. You know, we've long believed, I've always said that the one thing that bothers me sometimes about maybe even a worshipfulness of military folks is that I believe everybody should serve their country. And I say that as a small government libertarian type, a skeptic of government from top to bottom. Our country is us. It's the Constitution and it's the people. And we all need to be serving the country if we want it to be healthy and strong. And sometimes I worry people look to the military and tell them, you do it. Me, I'm going to chase money and do whatever I want.
Right. I feel that way sometimes. But then I look at statistics about 70% of the youth of America can't even meet the military minimum of height, weight standards, or they've been popped hot on a drug test or something like that. If you want to support your country, then get in shape, support your country, go vote. Don't commit crimes. Don't take drugs. Don't contribute to those kinds of things that are really bad for society. That's what concerns me. The military shouldn't be this, you know, fat farm, shouldn't be this place where people get their life straight. You know, the judge give you the order between jail or the military. Those are kind of the old days, because the military is a profession that, like anything else, is. And we want people that are highly competent, highly committed. And that's what's going to matter. It's just as it matters in the civilian world as well.
Mike Lyons. Hey, Mike, we can't thank you enough for the time. Really, really interesting. And we know the folks love it when you stop by. So thanks.
Thanks, guys. It's a privilege to be on with you guys when I am. I really, really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
You're too kind. All right. Thanks, Mike. Great to talk.
That actually is too kind. We don't deserve that.
No,
we don't.
No, that was.
It is not a privilege to be on our show. It's just, you know. It's nice of him to say.
I have so much guilt over so many things. Let me roll around in that for a moment.
I know where I am in life. I know where I am in life.
You've talked a little bit about the fact that you wanted for a long time in your childhood to be in the military, right?
I was planning on that clear through my senior year of high school. Military, the Marine recruiter was at our house. I was filling out paperwork, the whole thing.
Wow, you got that far?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And was it because you have to poop out in the open that freaked you out, or what? In the Marines. I remember when I made reference to a good friend of mine who's no longer with us, but when Scott told me that, that's what happens, I thought, oh, my God, I don't want to do that, which is ridiculous.
You know, several of my friends I was riding motorcycles with that summer before senior year, that sort of thing. I mean, we were riding motorcycles, God, all night long sometimes. Honest to God, all night long. Mm-hmm. They'd come honk outside my parents' house, and I'd hear them, and I'd go down, get dressed, and run downstairs before school was going to start. We'd be riding around motorcycles at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Rural Kansas, where you could actually, I remember one time on a hot night, stopping on the highway, and we took a little nap on the highway, laying down on the highway, because there's no cars.
In the lanes?
Yeah. Because the warmth was still on the, we were cold, and there was still warmth on the highway from the asphalt. There's no people.
Wow.
No cars. But anyway, they were going in the Marines, and they did go in the Marines. And I don't, for the life of me, remember why I didn't. I really don't. I became aware of the radio program, and you know the way you are when a kid, you're just like this way and that way. I think I became aware of this radio program, and I just, wow, that was the end of that.
That's interesting. I'm off this direction. Yeah, yeah. I was told that you can't get in if you'd ever smoked pot, and I'm afraid I'd cross that line.
Mm.
That was just not happening. This was in the 80s, keep in mind, which the need for guys was a little different than, you know, for instance, the Vietnam era or the never-ending Middle East conflict era.
Yeah,
I didn't have that problem. They could be picky in the 80s.
Yeah, I didn't have that problem, but I'm happy with the way my life turned out, so you don't want to change things if you could go back in a time machine, because maybe it wouldn't turn out good.
I hear you.
But I wish I'd have done it in some levels. I'd like to have seen, you know, because you do that sort of thing to see if you could do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you get to be a Marine for the rest of your life.
Yeah, which is very, very cool.
Sure.
I don't know, you know, how much we want to go into this, and I know both of us have stuff that we really probably shouldn't talk about with our families, but we didn't even mention during our chat with my clients. Well, you mentioned your brother is active duty Army and mine is active duty Navy. And that definitely has an influence on our perspective. Do you ever talk to your brother about, just in a macro way, how he feels about his military career?
He does not talk much.
Mm.
He does not talk much, period.
Yeah.
Which is a product of his military and war experience and combat experience.
Yeah,
he's one of those guys that does not talk about. He is a big regular people don't get it.
Yeah,
I can't talk to them.
I can understand
military guy.
I can understand it too. To the extent that I understand it.
It's very frustrating, but I can certainly understand it.
Yeah, you know, my dad. It's funny. It just popped into my head. My dad was an officer in the Air Force that got the rough side of Mike Lyons' tongue, didn't it? The Chair Force. Anyway, no disrespect to your Air Force guys. That's an old joke. Anyway, but my dad was an Air Force officer, and he did not encourage me to get into the military. He talked a little bit about how some of his commanding officers were arbitrary, and he just felt like there was a real lack of justice in it, and it felt like a gamble because you'd come across some son of a bitch who didn't like you, and he'd put a black mark on your record, and all it takes is one black mark.
I'm aware of that. My brother's had those experiences, definitely.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is I, the black sheep of the family, the older brother, decided that wasn't for me, plus there was the whole pot thing. But my little brother is going to retire after a 20-year-plus military career and has done great. And somehow avoided the black mark, probably because he got the good genes. I got the rotten genes. But he's had a mostly really positive experience being in the military. On the other hand, you know, he's a Navy guy. He's a submariner. And that's a very, very different experience than being infantry in the early 21st century.
I remember my brother and my dad talking about this one time because my dad asked my brother, he said, could they punch you in basic training? my brother said, no. He said, when I was in basic training, they could punch you, but they had to ask you first.
Your dad said that?
My dad said that.
Yeah.
He said they had changed that because they used to be able to just punch you.
Jeez.
So they could just walk up and punch you in the face.
Right.
Then there was some sort of change as we got soft, apparently, in the late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
They had to ask you. Of course, you had to say yes because you're, you know.
Private Armstrong, may I punch you in the face?
You're going to get punished if you didn't.
Sir, yes, sir.
Oh, my God.
You know,
they can't punch you.
At all? Oh. You know, that's another thing we could have talked to Mike about, was military discipline, how it's changed. He made mention of the fat farm thing. So obviously it has changed.
That's something. Yeah. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I did.
Here, here.